I call the November the 20th meeting for the Blue Mountain County Board of Supervisors to order. We begin with the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. All righty, do we have an adoption of the agenda?
So made.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. We have now adopted the agenda. We will begin, folks, with a very special recognition ceremony. We're going to recognize the veterans that are here with us tonight. But before I turn it over to Mr. Dahl, I want to say a special thank you to a former chair of the Blue Mountain Board of Supervisors, Mr. Len Gardner. Mr. Gardner, I'm not going to ask him how old he is, but he was on the USS Reed. I just asked him a little while ago. He was on the USS Reed in Pearl Harbor when Pearl Harbor was bombed on December the 7th. Thank you, Mr. Dahl.
So, as we're going through, and Kelly said not to say anything, but we thought this would be a great recognition for the veterans of Fluvanna County and just veterans in general. So we're going to go through and just kind of read something from the Board of Supervisors recognizing Fluvanna veterans, and then we'll have some armed services medley afterwards, and please stand up when your branch is called during music. So let me just read this first of all. So the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors would like to recognize Fluvanna veterans and all veterans. Whereas throughout our history, generations of men and women have answered the call to serve, leaving their homes, their families, and their jobs to willingly endanger their lives to defend our nation. And whereas for some that sacrifice has ended in permanent injury or death, yet their spirit remains in the continued preservation of our freedoms and the promise of liberty. And whereas the freedoms we enjoy as Americans have been purchased and maintained at a high price throughout our history. And whereas we owe a debt of gratitude to our veterans for their selfless service and to their families for their sacrifices. Now, therefore, the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors recognizes the service and sacrifice of the Fluvanna County men and women who have served our nation in the armed services and expresses its profound gratitude and appreciation, dated this November 20th, 2019, by John Michael, Chair and Chair of the Fluvanna Board of Supervisors. And Kelly's going to start the music, and then once your branch is played, please stand up.
Maybe she is. Doing it again. In 14 seconds.
Thank you.
so we can get one group photo with all the veterans that are here today with the Board of Supervisors. I guess we're having that's right. Good your opportunity, sir. Yes, sir.
He hides in the back.
No, it's okay. I might need you to squish a little bit.
Squish a little bit.
Squish a little bit. Squished. Debbie.
Squished.
All right, squished.
Landscape.
Thank you. Wait. Did somebody say wait?
You get in the way. No, you're fine.
Gotta say behind you. Okay.
We're good. Can I move?
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone.
I'd also, before we finish this off, if any of you had anything you wanted to say real quick, I know Ms. Dager said something. Yes, sir. Please step up to the witness chair.
My name is Dave Zimmerman, and actually, in all honesty, I live in Alamo County, but I'm a member of the Central Virginia Vets Association. We meet over at the Dogwood every month, a group of Flu Banner veterans. We were able, on October the 2nd, to take a reef up to Arlington and placed a reef at Arlington for the Flu Banner veterans. It was me, Billy Hess, who is a World War II veteran, member of Darby's Rangers, and two other, Ed Ferris is one, and John, I can't think of John's last name, but he was, both of them represented Vietnam as I did. So when y'all start talking, I heard about this tonight, I decided to bring y'all a photograph, but when I was looking at the photograph, it didn't come out as well as I wanted it to. I think we have it.
I'm working on it.
A copy of it that you can see on the big screen here.
Top one. There you go.
That maybe we can get it up. But if you can zoom in, I don't know if you can zoom in on that or not.
He'll figure it out.
But it shows you this reef was placed at Arlington for all the Flu Banner vets.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
My name is Linda Stager, and I'm sorry, I always get very nervous when I come up here. I came tonight on behalf of my father, who wouldn't come. He's 97, and he's planning his funeral. And he decided that he wanted to have a song at his funeral, America the Beautiful. So the reason I mentioned that is because I never really thought of him as a veteran or as very patriotic. And so when he said he wanted to have this song at his funeral, I said, well, tell me a little bit about your patriotism. He was in the Navy, and he served in World War II and the Korean War, and then he eventually retired from the Navy. And he's 97 now and still getting along fine. And he said, you know, I'm very proud that I served. And in fact, if they asked me to serve now, if I had to put my life on the line now, I would do it again.
Amen. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Once again, thank you all for everything that you've given. that just doesn't seem like enough to say. But, yeah. Mr. Dahl, you get to follow up.
Sure. I'll keep it quick. So, Mr. Chair, members of the board, so just a couple things to report, the co-ed report. So, one, the spotlight on business for this month is Modesto Farms. Modesto Farms is located on 952 Rolling Road in Scottsville. They have a website at www.modestofarms.com. They're a greenhouse that grows annuals, perennials, vegetables, herbs. Plants are sold in Charlottesville City Market. They're sold on Amazon. And on the farm in Fluvanna, you can buy directly from the farm. Modesto sells to many Northern Virginia locations, including the prestigious Omni Shoreham in Washington, D.C. And one other great thing, Modesto Farms is one of Fluvanna's 11 century farms, meaning a farm in operation for over 100 years by a descendant of the original owner. And plus, they have a great stock of eucalyptus trees that they grow even more than a lot of the surrounding states. So Modesto Farms is a spotlight on business this month. Also, so as the board knows, the Palmyra Area Revitalization Committee has been doing lots of great work to do lots of signage and lots of things in the village of Palmyra. So one thing that they presented the board about doing new slate signs on some of the historic buildings here in the village of Palmyra. So the first batch of signs came through. Calvin, how many signs were there, roughly?
Eight.
So we had eight slate signs that we're going to be putting on county buildings. They're about, dimensions are about six and three quarters by 12 inches. Private residents may be able to purchase these signs too for their private residences there in the village of Palmyra if they want to. It just gets a little complicated with county funds and county government doing though. But like I said, you'll start seeing these signs for different things going up in some of the buildings in the village of Palmyra. And so before we can put this horse to sleep here, the board asked at the last meeting, after we finally came up with the water tank logo, to show you kind of the final mock-up once we had it all kind of said and done. So number one here is kind of the final mock-up of what we have. The board wanted just the kind of the logo that we've been using on a lot of our marketing materials, saying Fluvanna, established in 1777, and we put up there learn, work, and play. And just as some other ideas, like I said, we showed you just some other variations of that, but number one was what the board wanted. So before I completely say, boom, this is going on the water tank, I want to make sure that as the board requested, they want to see the final product. So number one is it.
I would space the words a little bit more up top.
Space the words a little bit more?
A little higher up, just so it's not sitting like right on top of it.
A little higher up or just spaced out?
Higher and spaced. Take out that thing. That's what I would do.
Okay. We can easily make those last minute tweaks. Mm-hmm. Any other further questions? If not, we're going to see a fantastic water tower logo here. I'm not sure when it's going to go on there. With all the cold weather, they may delay the painting a little bit because the water tank weather has to generally be above 40 degrees, so we've had some cold snaps here, so I'm not sure when it's going to happen, but you'll start seeing at some point, either it's soon or it'll be in springtime, the tank being painted and the logos going up. So just kind of keep a lookout. And then just for some of the next Board of Supervisors meeting, we'll have a regular meeting at 4 p.m. on December 4th. At 7 p.m., we're also going to, if you remember, we're going to have a Fluvanna County Public Schools, kind of just a preliminary budget discussion with them, the superintendent, and maybe we're still kind of figuring out if it's going to be just the superintendent or the superintendent and board members, but we'll kind of just do a little work session here in the courtroom at 7 p.m. on December 4th. On December 18th at 4 p.m., prior to the regular meeting, we're going to have U.S. budget work session. Basically, we're going to have the first round of nonprofit presentations on the 18th, and then at 7 p.m., so from 4 to 6, we'll have nonprofit presentations, then from 6 to 7, we'll break for dinner, and then at 7 p.m., we'll have our regular meeting. And that is all that I have for the board this evening.
Any questions? I'd like to add one more thing. I don't know if this is the place to put it, but I'll talk about it, but you were there. they did the dedication of the auditorium. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah. There was a dedication done this Sunday at 2 o'clock to name the auditorium at Central Elementary School after Reverend or Mr. Paul Spraggs and Ms. Elva Key. So they had a huge banner where the curtain is in the auditorium, which said Spraggs and Dash and Key. Mr. Spraggs was the first principal of Central Elementary School in 1958 when the first classes went into the building. It was a consolidated school for African American children, and he was there for 26 years. Mrs. Key was not the first secretary, but she came in a few years later, and she was there for at least 39 years. And Mr. Spraggs is deceased, but his son, Paul Spraggs Jr., who was a teacher here in Fluvanna County at the high school, came to represent him. Mrs. Key came to talk for herself. She was just as cute as a button. She didn't expect those jokes. But that was a tremendous honor for Central to be able to let the children know the history of Central and why it was built and the people there that made it, helped to make it what it is today. And we are very thankful to the community for contributing funds so that we could put that big, beautiful banner in the auditorium. Thank you.
And I see some young people sitting out there. Guys, I gotta tell y'all, you want to know what discipline was? Or you want to know what scary was?
Mrs. Spraggs.
Reverend Spraggs. She's saying Mr. Spraggs being nice. He was the principal.
Yes.
He was the reverend. And since we're talking about Veterans Appreciation, I believe he was a Marine drill sergeant.
Yes.
Now, you talk about the trifecta of scary. I went in there one time, and he and I in a maple tree had a nice discussion. And about 10 seconds later, I was a whole lot smarter. I can tell you that much right now. I never went to see him again. But Miss Key was sitting outside going, "It'll be all right, honey. You know you shouldn't have done it." She made me feel better.
Let me say something.
Yes, sir.
Tell you a little story about my son. My son had acted up, and Mr. Spraggs had called him in, so I had to take him over to the school. Unbeknownst to me, he had padded his pants very well because Mr. Spraggs was well known for using the paddle. So when I got over there, I said, you know, give him his punishment because he knew what was coming. He said, no, I'm going to let him go this time. Why let him go? I don't know. But he also got it from me. So there you go.
I wish he'd been that nice to me. But anyway, there are stories about them. I mean, two wonderful people, and it could not have been named after two better folks. Now, we'll move forward with the first round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board, please step to the witness chair at this time. State your name, your address, and keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak at this time?
Yeah, last year I was up in my hometown and had been asked to speak to the high school group that was graduating that year. And it happened to be 80 years since I had graduated from that same school. And I started my comments by saying that when I was their age in that hometown, during the Memorial Day services and the parades, veterans from the Civil War, actually still living in the town, came out and witnessed the parades. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Here I was 80 years later after I graduated, I had provided a link between what was current and what was over 100 years earlier. I was 19 when I joined the Navy in 1940, and I was sent to Pearl Harbor and came aboard a destroyer. It was still peacetime, and on December 7, I was just getting up. The general alarm was blaring, but that was nothing, because usually the general alarm was blaring at 8 o'clock as a routine test every Sunday morning. So nobody paid any attention to the alarm going off. But just as I came out on deck, a Japanese plane, I didn't know it was Japanese at the time, but a plane came gliding down off, coming over the mountains and in the center of Oahu, and glided down onto Ford Island. And as it came over pretty close over our ship, I could see the red ball on the plane. And I watched the plane glide down, and it dropped something on Ford Island, and whoa, it was a big explosion. And that was my introduction to World War II. Up to that point, we were in a peaceful condition. A lot of our crew were still ashore, having a big weekend liberty. The captain was ashore. Most of the officers were ashore. As soon as the bombs started falling, I was ordered to wake up the crew. Well, the crew was that had been out all night, or half the night before going in to lay down in their bunks, didn't appreciate my going down there and trying to roast them up, because this was their weekend, their day off. But when the guns on our ship started firing, they woke up and jumped out of bed in a hurry. Our ship was all broken down. Our instruments, our valves, and that sort of thing were over on the tender being calibrated. We were in cold steel, as they called it in the engine room, because there was no fire in the boilers. And we were getting our water and all our electricity and stuff for the tender alongside which we were moored. But we rushed over to the tender and got our gear back and put the ship back together in record time. We were out of the harbor by late morning, and we were one of the first ships out. By late morning, of course, the attack was all over. There were two waves, about 300 planes in all together under both waves, We steamed out past the battleships that were burning, sinking. A couple of them were capsized. One was the Oklahoma. The other was the target ship, an old battleship called the Utah. And they were upside down. Some of their crew was on the bottom of the ship, waving us on as we made our way out to the harbor. But the question was in our minds is what was waiting out there? Where did those planes come from that had bombed us? We had no idea where the Japanese fleet was. Obviously, they surprised us. And so it was kind of a touchy thing going out of the harbor. We were rendezvoused with other ships, a couple of cruisers and a couple of destroyers that were got out of the harbor. And we circled the island and looked for the enemy, and found none, fortunately. The war went on from there. We that night we were underway, circling the island with no lights on the ship. That was the first time for us. No lights. And it was kind of spooky as we went through the Kauai Channel. But the war went on, and our ship, we continued in the Pacific Ocean. We were in the Battle of Midway. We were prepared midway for the battle, with escorting ships that were bringing supplies and goods to the island. And we were also then assigned to the Aleutian Islands, which was part of the Battle of Midway. The Japanese in the Battle of Midway had sent its main force against Midway, but had a secondary force attacking the Aleutian Islands. They had two carriers up there, several cruisers and destroyers. But it was the secondary target for the Japanese. Of course, we didn't know that until at that time. Our ship continued on in the Pacific. We were in the Battle of Guadalcanal, and we continued on to New Guinea, which with in MacArthur's Navy, as they called us. We skip-hopped along the New Guinea coast. Japanese were out there in force. Then I was transferred to other ships and went back to the Pacific in another ship, and went on to battles of Philippines. My ship that I'd been on was sunk in the Philippines. And then we went on to Okinawa. And that's my story.
Glenn?
Mr. Darby.
Hey, you can't hear me. I was going to ask you about the aircraft carriers, the two aircraft carriers. Can you say something about those?
The Japanese two aircraft carriers?
No, it was Americans.
Oh, the Americans. The American aircraft carriers were in a task force heading back to Pearl Harbor Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th. But they had been delayed because one of the ships in their task force had an engine trouble or something or other, and they were delayed while they did some repairs out there. And so our two carriers did not arrive in Pearl Harbor until the next day, which was very fortunate for the U.S.
Yeah.
Time. Seeing no one, I will now close the first round of public comment. We will now move forward to public hearing. A, ordinance amendment of Code Chapter 8, Section 8-1, Ms. Smith.
Good evening. So this is basically every other year, the Office of OEMS comes in and does inspections, and one of the things they wanted this year was to see where the board had given fire permission to basically run EMS calls in the county, and we could not find anything from 20, 30 years ago. So this is just cleaning up that request from the Office of OEMS by November 30th. Just adding that wording, adding that wording in.
So the proposed amendment says, in addition to foregoing all fire companies hereto organized and operating within the county are hereby approved to provide EMS services in accordance with section 15.2-955 of the Code of Virginia, provided that fire company has a valid emergency medical services agency license issued by the Virginia Office of OEMS, blah, 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 and all applicable law. So that's the big change to this ordinance section. It's just putting some very specific language in there.
Making it okay to do what we've been doing.
This language has been approved by that office.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. All righty. Any questions? All righty. Since I'm hearing none, we will now open the public hearing. Please keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Is there anyone wishing to speak to the board at this time? Seeing none, I'll now close the public hearing. Are there any questions from the board or any comments?
No.
All right, do we have a motion?
I move the board approve the proposed amendment of Chapter 8, Section 8-1 of the Urbana County Code authorizing existing fire companies to provide EMS services.
Second.
Got a motion made by Ms. Seeger, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. All right. We will now move forward with action matters. At tab B, Dewberry Engineers Incorporated, Project Agreement 6, Ms. Tolman.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So this is for Dewberry Engineers to do a water distribution system optimization study for Zion Crossroads. More or less what this is going to tell us is how much water we need in the system, in the tank, to keep the water from becoming stagnant. If the water sets too long, it grows
bacteria stuff.
Makes the water
good,
bad.
Not good stuff.
And these compounds have actually been found to be cancer-causing, which we don't want any of that growing in there.
Might add to advertising if it glowed a little bit.
So once the system is in use, this study, if we're following this plan that they put together, will keep the water from becoming stagnant. It is considered an operational expense, not a construction expense, so we cannot use the debt service that's in place now. So we're also asking for the funds to cover the study. The project agreement is $22,366. Are there any questions?
And the one thing to add to this too, I mean, so one of the things, once we get the system online, it's not like we're going to have, you know, full utilization
right.
of the
right.
system day one. So initially, we need to figure out how to keep the water and keep the stagnation from happening in the pipes and in the system, keeping the proper flows in the tank. So this is, it's a necessary thing to get going right off the bat.
Right.
Would this be a reoccurring expense or is it
one time?
No, one time.
And this may be one of those things where you get the fire companies to go up there, the fire hydrants that I'm sure we're putting on.
Well, and there may be other things too. I mean, there may be times, and like I said, since we're going to have an interconnection with Louisa County too, and with their systems, there may be times where they want to take their system offline to do maintenance, and there may be some type of agreement where they pull water through our system. So which in actuality kind of helps our system and keeps the water from being stagnant, unless we just get just a tremendous amount of customers day one. So, but this has been a necessary thing.
So how soon will our water be in the coming down pipe?
So right now they're talking about substantial completion is in April
okay.
of 2020. Final completion is October 2020. I know right now, the contractors are a little ahead of schedule, but I think for certain it'll probably be sometime in between the April and October time frame. I don't expect there to be any delays.
You're within a year.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Any questions from the board?
So you really, you actually have two motions. The first motion is to approve the funding. The second motion is to approve the agreement.
Okay.
No questions for anyone? No comment. Okay. Do I have a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a supplemental appropriation of $22,366 from unassigned fund balance to the Zion Crossroad Water and Sewer Fund budget for Water Distribution System Optimization Study to establish the funds necessary for Project Agreement 6.
Second.
Motion's made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Ms. Seeger. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 5-0. Motion number 2.
I move the Board of Supervisors to approve Project Agreement Number 6 between Sylvania County and Dewberry Engineers Incorporated for a water distribution system optimization study not to exceed $22,366 and further authorize the County Administrator to execute the agreements subject to approval as deformed by the County Attorney.
Second.
Motion made again by Ms. Booker, seconded by Ms. Seeger. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Thank you very much. We will go to C, Blue Mountain Historical Society payment forgiveness request.
I'll have Mr. Moss come up and I'll kind of start off the conversation here a little bit, then I'll leave it up to Mr. Moss. So Mr. Moss, as president of the Savannah Historical Society, sent me an email about a couple weeks ago. If you remember when the Farm Heritage Museum kind of came on, there were certain costs at the time that the Historical Society said they were going to pay for some additions to the Farm Heritage Museum, as well as for Fluvanna County putting some money into the Farm Heritage Museum. They would forego some, give some contributions in years to come for 5 years. And then in addition, they would forego their $550 a year that the county was contributing to the Fluvanna Historical Society. Back on June 5th of this year, so there's about $10,800 that for some change orders that the Historical Society said they were going to pay the county. Mr. Moss came back to the county at the time for a payment forgiveness for that amount, for the 10-8, I think it was 886 or something. And at that time, the board forgave that amount. And then subsequently now, we're back. Mr. Moss and the Historical Society came back for looking for payment forgiveness of what amounts to $20,000. So when the Historical Society was forgiven the $10,800 and some change, they made their first $5,000 payment to Fluvanna County, which leaves four or $5,000 payments remaining. So it's basically $20,000 that the Historical Society is looking to get payment forgiveness on. And I have Mr. Moss's letter that I will pull up. And then you all saw the letter in your package, and I'll let Mr. Moss kind of just go from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I'm not here to dispute in any way the guarantees that we at the Historical Society made in order to finish the Farm Heritage Museum. That included the painting of the building, which was not in the original contract. And it also included the light fixtures, both internal and external, the sconces that are on the outside. I do contend that the changes that we made and requested, the Historical Society requested the okay of the supervisors to do those things, made the building into a much more attractive building. And in fact, it probably laid the groundwork for it being nominated and winning the second place in the nation for a stick-borne building in that particular year. So, as you know, it has opened now, and it is very popular, and we continue to work on the exhibits that are inside. What I prepared for you is a memo that I thought would trigger in your minds both the magnitude and scope of the Historical Society's efforts in Fluvanna County over the years. We have worked in a series of what I call private and public-private partnerships I don't know whether you realize, but for rural county, that kind of public-private partnership is very rare. And it has been extremely successful in this county. It has resulted in, I think, transforming Palmyra in many ways, and it certainly has resulted in changing the entire nature of your property at Pleasant Grove. So I'm sort of patting the Historical Society on its back for the work that it has done. Not all of that money came from the Historical Society, obviously. We worked to assist the county putting in a series of T21 grants. All of those T21 grants we applied for were actually approved. Why were they approved? They were approved mainly because the community supported them. Because in the packages that went to VDOT for those grants were strong letters of support from the Rivanna Conservation Society, the Historical Society, and the Heritage Trail Foundation. Do I contend that those T21 grants would not have been approved without support? Hard to tell, but I think it certainly made it much more certain that we received those grants, which were in some cases $200,000 or $300,000. So this cooperative effort has now continued. As you know, we run the only county historical museum for the county and the Old Stone Jail. We used to get $1,000 from the county every year. About 7 years ago, it was reduced to $550, and now we receive nothing. And last year, a community or 501c3 nonprofit in this county received $10,000, and I'm not envying the fact that they received that. I think they deserve it. But we received nothing. Not only do we receive nothing, but we're going to have to pay you for what I think were changes to the Farm Museum that made it a great building. Also, after the building, the Farm Museum was completed, the Historical Society spent $20,000 both designing and installing the exhibits at the Farm Museum. The county contributed nothing for that. And as most of you who've gone through the museum know, it is very, very interesting museum and has received very positive comments from everyone. And after that, we just spent $15,600 of our own money to build the fence around the historic Hayden Cemetery, which is in front of the Pleasant Grove House. And if you've been out to look at it, you know it's a fantastic addition to that entire historic area in and around the Pleasant Grove House. I'm asking you quite simply to forego the payment of $5,000 a year over the next 4 years, and absent that, if you can't see in your wisdom to do that, to reduce the amount that we have to pay. We do an endowment solicitation letter to our members every February, and it brings in exactly $5,000. That means the money that we would be putting for future projects would be going to Fluvanna County. I don't regret paying the $5,000 that we paid this year. As soon as I was notified that we owed it to you, I paid it immediately. So I ask you to consider the totality of what we have done for Fluvanna County over the years, and the fact that $20,000 is for the Historical Society a large amount of money. We're not going to go broke paying this amount of money, but it certainly doesn't help us in our own finances. We are, after all, a nonprofit organization. We are the largest membership organization in Fluvanna County and the largest membership organization in the history of this county. We also sponsor and put money up front for Old Farm Day, which is a subcommittee of the Historical Society. It is the largest public event in the history of Fluvanna County. We pay thousands of dollars in preparation for Old Farm Day each year. Now, we recoup that amount of money from the vendors and from the people who attend, and it makes a modest profit. But for the last 7 years, The Historical Society has given 50% of the net proceeds from Old Farm Day to the Farm Heritage Museum. It helped build the Farm Museum. So that's my presentation to you, and I appreciate all of you, everything that you have done, because what we have done together would not have been possible without the cooperation of our elected officials. It was the elected officials who worked with the Heritage Trail Foundation, the Historical Society, to do the many things that we have managed to do in this county, and I thank you. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Moss, thank you for your service, by the way. Thank you for your service, by the way. Can you speak a little bit about membership in the society right now, and where it stands, and attracting new members, and sort of the health of the membership?
Our membership has declined a bit over the years, unfortunately, and as a matter of fact, at our board meeting yesterday, we had a detailed discussion of this. We are doing some new outreach for membership. We right now have, I think it's 450 members. We have quite a few members in addition to that where we cooperate with other historical societies, but their membership is free. Membership is now $25 a year for individual and families. We have quite a few people who have life memberships, which are $300. Our membership over the last two or three years has been very steady. We just did a mailing to our members who had lapsed over the last year and a half, and we received 30 new members of that group who re-upped, became members again. So we are still, our membership is impressive for a county of this size. I think it's the largest membership of a historical society for any county this size in the whole Commonwealth of Virginia, I would guess.
And out of the 450, what percentage are active?
Pardon me?
Out of the 450, what percentage are sort of active in your
efforts?
Well,
we have a lot of volunteers.
The majority of your
We have volunteers who work in the archives. We have volunteers that work on Second Sundays. Our Second Sunday, Saturday a week ago, pulled 100 people into the village of Palmyra. I was sitting in giving the spiel in the historic courthouse about the courthouse, and after talking for 3 hours, I was a bit fatigued, shall I say, because we had just a constant stream of people. And very interesting, I would say 50% of the people who came to Second Sundays had never been to Palmyra and were newcomers to this county, which I found very encouraging. And quite a few of them were young people. And we got about 10 or 15 new members out of that group on Saturday a week ago. I'm not sure if I have that.
That's fine. And lastly, do you track the number of hours that your volunteers give towards their services?
Yes.
What was that number last year?
I don't really know. We track it only for one reason, and that is if we put in a grant, you can use it for an in-kind match. Otherwise, it just is the statistic.
Rough guess?
I don't know. I would guess that we probably have two or three people working every day at Maggie's house during the week in the archives.
Do you have any future projects coming up?
Yes, we're doing a very interesting project, being a sort of cyber nerd. I really don't understand it, but anyway, we're doing a program Saturday, brought 50 people out who have cemeteries on their land,
yes.
Family cemeteries, giving them information from people in the state government about the laws and regulations that deal with family cemeteries and their preservation. Right now, we are working with Louisa County to do a new, very sophisticated computer system that will generate maps of all of the cemeteries in Savannah County initially, and then ultimately all of the historic areas, buildings, etc., in the county. And that would work with the park committee, because the park committee is planning to do a virtual tour of the village of Palmyra. We would add that to the virtual tour of the entire county of Savannah. It also will be of great use for economic development and the development of tourism. So that project is a multi-year project. It's just gotten underway. And I'm very positive about it, and I think we're going to make great progress with it. And the program is a brand new Microsoft program that allows this kind of digital mapping that is completely new. Wow. Yeah. Other questions?
I was going to ask you, do y'all ever work with the high school classes at all?
With what?
With the high school classes at all, with the young people?
Well, it's interesting because a teacher of history at the high school, Mr. Pace,
yes,
is now beginning a history class on the history of Savannah County, and we are cooperating with him in setting up the curriculum and also trying to arrange how we can enrich his course on new course on Savannah history by visits to our courthouse, to the Old Stone Jail, and to the Holland Page 1867 log cabin. So there are all kinds of things that we can do to enrich what he is beginning to do, and this is a completely new program. It didn't come from us, it came from him. He was the one who started.
Well, I remember bringing my Helping Hands class over to Holland Page one day, and we turned the garden over for you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a big time sticking a shovel in the ground and turning it all over. Yeah. And said, yeah, this is how they used to garden. This is all about fun.
And,
yeah.
And you're also doing a list of African American leaders in Fluvanna County, and you're presenting it to the middle school students.
Right. Our next bulletin that will be published in January, we hope, is on... and I'm sorry, I think his name was Mr. Blair. He mm-hmm. was the first African-American yeah. elected official in 1867 mm-hmm. and was actually a member of the Virginia General Assembly after the Emancipation Proclamation. One of our interns, believe it or not, did all of the research on this man and his family, mm-hmm. and he has written the bulletin that will come out in January. So it should be a very interesting story about an aspect of Savannah African American history that was until recently almost unknown.
Right. Yeah. Because my church has the first African American elected to the General Assembly and during the Reconstruction period, and that was James Barry.
Yeah.
He was there from 1868. Okay. Yeah. So history continues.
Any other questions?
Do y'all have any questions?
You? Well, no, but I do want to say some things as far as my feelings are concerned. I know that when I think that government should be run like a business, I know that I'm delusionary. I know that good deeds do not relieve most people of other responsibilities they have, such as financial commitment. I know that every man, woman, and child in Fluvanna is burdened with a debt of about $3,500 each. I know that there was no interest added to the $20,000 figure. Where can you get a deal like that but with the government? I know that the Historical Society does a super, super job. They got my A-plus rating. Not many people get that. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. All right. Are there any questions?
Well, I have a couple of comments. This is, and I appreciate everything that you've done for Fluvanna. You're an amazing man. And you were able to get an unbelievable amount of money for the county through grants. But we were under the impression that this was a loan, and that I see this as a default. So I'm sorry, but I would think that we'd have to work something out.
Okay, I would just point out that absent that loan, there would be no farm museum today, period. Mm-hmm. And the $278,000 the Historical Society raised for it would still be in the bank.
Well, yeah, and I guess maybe a lot of us didn't have to forestall it. In other words, if I'm going to build a house, and all once I don't come up with the money, it's going to have to be done the next year or the next year. And it certainly has happened to me that when funds didn't come in like I thought they were, I had to move it on back, so I had to cope with it, with the issues. And the issue here is not what you all did. You and the people who work with you, it can't be enough said about you. I've been in the barn over there several different times, and it is marvelous. And I know that you are the catalyst who has done all this. But then I'm responsible also to the taxpayers. So that's sort of the way I feel about it.
I have no problem approving to forgive the $20,000.
Anyone else? Already?
Well, I think, especially on a day like today when we recognize veterans and we recognize the history of our nation, and when we had Mr. Gardner talking about standing in front of veterans that had served in the Civil War, that one of the real richnesses in our society of Fluvanna here is the Historical Society. At 450 members, it represents about 1.5% of the population, which I find kind of interesting that you draw that many members. I would have to guess that you probably donate 5,000 to 6,000 hours at a minimum. That's only 10 hours per member per year. If you break that math down and you say, what are we paying in respect to that $5,000 that is not money going out but money coming in, it's a pretty minor amount. $10 per person is what I think what it calculates out to. And then if you look at the return that we get in those volunteer hours, both in terms of tangible physical things, yes, the farm museum, the parks, the trails, the knowledge that is passed down, that's an immeasurable value to the county. And I respect the fact that, this is a difficult decision because, to Mr. Weaver's point, you make a commitment, and when you make that commitment, it's reasonable for everybody to expect you to follow through. But to Mr. Moss's point, he's also pointing out that there were additional costs, and that those costs came out of their own fundraising efforts, and that those fundraising efforts and that this money matters to them now. They put a lot out, and it matters to them. And I would say that it is not in our benefit to collect $5,000 at the cost of the enthusiasm and the goodwill of the Historical Society.
Yeah, and I think with the Farm Heritage Museum, I for one was pushing, saying, boy, we've got to get this done, because Mr. May, who put all of his historical farm things there, was in his 95 years. I'm saying, at least we need to break the ground so he can have the shovel, but he's still living, thank God. And he had an opportunity to see that heritage museum built, and the exhibits that you have in there. It's such a credit. Because I was concerned at first about where's the African American history. You all have dug up African American history. We didn't even know. A good friend of mine's father is in there driving a horse and wagon, which I knew him. And so they brought so much history behind it. So the $20,000, just to me, it's not a whole lot of money. And I think you all have put forth in just your effort far above that. And I'm kind of feeling a little bit sad or not good that we were quiver over $20,000 after everything that the Historical Society has done and continues to do. I don't like that feeling that we need to have. Never mind.
All righty.
Yeah.
Do we have a motion?
I move. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I move the Board of Supervisors approve a payment forgiveness request for the Fluvanna County Historical Society in the amount of $20,000 for a payment agreement for the Farm Heritage Museum.
Second.
We have a motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
I have to ask one question. I want to make sure I have this correct.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that y'all put out $35,600 since this point?
Right.
Okay. And the chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-2.
Thank you, members of the board.
There are no appointments tonight. Presentations. D, Virginia Governor's School intern presentation. Ms. Rice. And you know what? I recognize you. This is Ms. Notman.
That's right. Instead of Ms. Rice, Ms. Rice was a good name to put in there, but this is Ms. Notman. She's going to do an intern presentation on the Virginia Governor's School. And I'll pull up the brief for you. You want me to go slide by slide? Or?
Is this your project?
I guarantee you she knows how to use that mouse.
Is this your project?
This is my Governor's School project.
And you did it here in the county. I mean, you did it here.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. No help from that useless guy in the back.
I know that.
Meeting. I am Jocelyn Altman, and I did an internship with the Vanderbilt County Government, and then I turned it into my VRBGS year project. First, I'm going to talk about what VRBGS is. Stanford Virtual Governor's School. It is a program for students that want to challenge themselves. You apply for it in eighth grade, and you have certain classes you take 9th, 10th, and 11th, but senior year, you can choose your own topic and kind of run with it. So my broad topic was local government, and I interned with several different offices in Savannah County, and I'm doing community service at Savannah County Public Library. The first day of my internship, I met with Ms. Harris and just kind of got a broad overview of how Savannah's government is structured and how people come into the positions they come into, whether they're elected or appointed. And then the next day, I met with the Commissioner of the Revenue's Office. Mr. Sherman was not in that day, so I met with Ms. Hudgens, Ms. Sherman, and Ms. Pullen. And then that day I went over to Treasury and met with Ms. Lerner and the clerks of the Treasury. The next week I met with Finance, I met with Ms. Swisdale, and learned what finance was, what payroll was, what accounts payable meant, what accounts receivable meant, and I then went to each person individually in the department and talked with them. The next day I came in, I went with Parks and Rec with Ms. Payne, Mr. Spitzer, and Mr. Morris, and it's nothing like the TV show. but it was informative, and I'm glad for the opportunity. And the next department was Community Development, where I spoke with Mr. Robinson, Senior Planner, and Ms. Porter, Clerk of Planning, and learned a lot goes on that I don't know about during the day. And that's and this department is where I came up with my research question for my paper. I had this set of questions prepared that I used for every person I met with. And I interviewed Mr. Robinson, and he talked about how he had worked in a county or a town in North Carolina, and how he felt the students since they were very involved, and I thought that was interesting, and I decided to write research if there was something to how locality size plays into civic participation. And the final day of my internship, I met with Ms. Joyce, Ms. Pace, voter registrar, and learned about the different ballots and how why voting is important. So like I said, I learned the basic speech department, and I picked out my research topic, which was how locality size affects local government. And I wrote my paper, and I, as I was researching, I discovered that there isn't
one size that's perfect for local government. There's, because size just ties into a lot of factors like population size, but also how dense is the population, how isolated is the locality, and all of this plays into how engaged citizens are and how much they want to vote, come to board meetings or town hall meetings, or speak and reach out to their officials.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very well done, young lady.
Thank you.
I do have to tell you though, guys, my nephew that was in Goochland was in governor's school, and his senior project, he actually did an internship at the funeral home for his senior project. And Ms. Noslin, you did an awesome job. I know you're not the loudest person. I talk a whole lot more than you do. But you did a wonderful, she did it. I'm telling you right now, couldn't be prouder of you, young lady. I'd also like, before we go any further, we did our veterans thing tonight. We just had a veteran walk into the room. I mean, he might need help getting up. He's an Army guy and National Guard guy, and Commissioner Revenue, my brother.
I thought you were in the Navy, weren't you?
No.
Apple.
Army.
Helicopter pilot.
He's one of those fools that jumped out of a perfectly good airplane.
Okay.
Next, E, spot blight abatement, Mr. Dahl.
So it'll be myself, Mr. Payne, and then Mr. Zoll can kind of come up, and we'll kind of tell you where we are with spot blight. I'll kind of start off, and then we'll kind of let Mr. Zoll get into it a little bit here. So just as you remember, so back when Mr. Nichols was county administrator, he originally kind of brought property maintenance, rental districts, rental inspection districts, spotlight ordinance back to the board back at the June 15th work session. At that time, the board said, you know what, we kind of want to go with the spotlight ordinance because it was the less, I guess it was the less intrusive. It would kind of require a little less staffing to maintain the program. We then brought back spotlight again at the August 7th BOS work session. And at that point, we kind of laid out a process to do spotlight at the time. And, you know, kind of the process was we had to kind of come into the building official, then it would kind of go through the planning commission, then it would go to the board of supervisors, there would be public hearings. At that time, the board decided, you know, let's just kind of skip the planning commission piece and let's just kind of make it a little more streamlined because there's a lot more kind of dates and time periods involved. And as we kind of go through the process, we'll have Mr. Zoll talk about that. But after Mr. Miles and Community Development, Mr. Zoll and Mr. Payne discuss spotlight a little bit more, they really realized that we don't need to do any type of separate ordinance for that. So I'll kind of let them kind of get into this a little bit here. So, Kevin, you want to start off?
Yeah, no, you said like you wanted to say something, but
I think it might be easy for me to start.
That's fine.
To be absolutely honest with you, I didn't remember that we have already addressed this issue with the spotlight. Mr. Sheridan looks quizzical because Mr. Sheridan was not on the board in 2008. I discovered my file is from 2008. We discussed the issue then, and that is when we formalized the ordinance that we have on what's the word I should use? Dangerous buildings and other structures. Mr. Nichols really did focus on this statute, and that is Virginia Code 36-49.1:1. It's a very specialized statute. There are two reasons that we do not need an ordinance. Number one is that statute does not authorize the adoption of an ordinance. It does not need an ordinance to be adopted. It's self-effectuating. And what it does is it allows the county or any other entity, including housing authorities, to take action to appropriate action to abate these blighted conditions. You don't need an ordinance authorizing it. The statute does it directly. The second reason that you don't need an ordinance on this is that the only additional remedy that the that this statute really authorizes is purchase of the blighted properties. So that, for example, if you take some of the places in Columbia we've had from time to time, this would authorize you to go in and buy the building. Now, the alternative to that, which is also authorized by that statute, is to order the owner to correct the blight in whatever fashion that is, up to and including tearing it down. The problem with using this statute for that is that we already have an ordinance on that subject, on exactly that subject. And that's what was adopted in 2008. It's found in, I don't know which paper I'm looking at. Chapter 5, Article 3 of the County Code. And it's the first section is 531. The owner of property in the county shall remove, repair, and or secure any building, wall, or other structure owned by him, which shall be determined by the Board of Supervisors to constitute a danger to the health or safety of any resident of the county. And then it goes forward and establishes a procedure for that. You already have that in effect. You can use it today. So the impact of the Title 36 statute really is to provide procedure for investigating complaints of this sort of thing. Again, you don't need an ordinance to authorize it. You already have that authority. So the one thing that I will say is that this statute does allow additional authority for entities other than localities, other than counties, cities, and towns. It's in the housing title, and it specifically relates to housing authorities. It's pretty clear to me, based on the legislative history of it, that that's what it was really intended to do, was to allow additional authority to go to housing authorities as well as to the county or city. So I'm not saying it has no use. It does have use, but it's not anything that you need to worry about now. It simply speaks to the procedure, and you can do that administratively. Mr. Zoll and I have talked about it, and I think I'm going to speak for him, but I think he's comfortable with that.
I agree with you, yes.
Yeah, and so if you want, we'll go through it, like I said. So blighted property criteria, here is blighted property criteria right now. And Mr. Payne, I'm assuming some of this criteria would still kind of apply to our current ordinance.
It all applies.
It all applies.
And the board then finds, based on Mr. Zoll's examinations, his investigations, the board could then order the remedies of repair, or securing, or tearing down of the structure upon those evidence produced by those complaints. Now, I will say one other thing, and that is there is an ancillary remedy in the statute that if you spend public money securing these problems, you're entitled to charge it back to the owner and affix a lien on the property, which is of the same character and dignity as a tax lien. However, you have exactly the same right under Chapter 5 ordinance. So again, the remedy is cumulative. And in fact, the statute uses the word remedy, the word cumulative with respect to the remedies.
So we're going to talk about the blighted property, and then here's this kind of a potential list of conditions that could occur that would, you know, require us to go out and look at a blighted property: condemned structure, rat road infestation, previous citations, inadequate facilities, potential trespass, nuisance to children, fire hazard, and et cetera, et cetera. I'll have Mr. Zoll, he'll kind of go through what the process is and what the procedure is. you've seen this before, but we've streamlined it a little bit more. So, Mr. Mazzola, you want to go through what the process is?
Yeah. So, and then the last time we talked, we wanted to keep it simple and as simple for you guys as possible. So, we've taken community development out of this. But basically, what this is for us now is that we have the power, we have the ordinance, we know what the target is, but how are we actually going to, you know, wield that power? How are we going to do it? And we thought the best. From what we gathered, you guys, was, you know, the ordinance says right off the bat, it says the Board of Supervisors shall have the authority. But it doesn't really tell you how to get there. It doesn't tell you how you're going to implement this plan. So basically what that is. So basically a complaint has to be made. Now, we thought it best if the complaint goes to the Board of Supervisors or to the County Supervisors or comes through that and that route only, okay? It's not just someone coming into my office, because then what happens is if someone comes in and makes a complaint, anyone can initiate this process, and then I could have 4, 5, 6, 7 of them coming through. And by the time it gets to you guys, you don't have any say in it. Now it's all of a sudden a public hearing. So I think the best thing to do is it has to come through the Board of Supervisors as an initial complaint to the community development, and then ultimately to me. And then I would go out and do basically the number two there, which is I go out and investigate the property and see if it does meet the spot blight criteria. And if it does, I give the owner 30 days notice to come in with a plan. If he does, he's got 90 days to complete the work. If neither one of those two or that part does not follow through with the owner, then I basically bring it to the board at, you know, for a hearing. And then basically at that point, I give you the all the information I have, all the evidence I have, and then you make a decision whether or not you want to go ahead or stop right there or how we proceed. So from that point on, it's up to the board how we go.
Yeah, so 4, 5, and 6 here, as Mr. Zoll said, if the owner fails to respond, there's 30 days to move forward, and then we could schedule for a public hearing before the board, and then the board could then, as you said, they could approve, they could deny, they can modify, they can reject, whether or not they feel that property is blight.
When it seems to me, I mean, I can understand the reasons for number one. You know, you don't want just anybody making random, or I don't want to say random, but
sure,
you know, saying, hey, I want you to look at whether this qualifies for spot blight. However, if one of the reasons why it would fall under spot blight is because there's already been 3 citations, wouldn't that automatically sort of fall into the review of the board through the building or through your office at that point in time?
If there was already 3 citations on it, you mean from my office?
Yep.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen because we're not doing that right now, unless it was something like an unsafe structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically a structure that needs to be knocked down and people have to be kicked out.
Sure.
No one's come to me with that yet.
No, but I'm just saying procedurally, that could happen,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
and in that kind of a situation, if step number one is that it has to come from the board and or the county administrator,
that's for the spotlight, against right, something that you want to basically abate the problem. You want to go to the owner and say, we need you to fix this. If it's something falling down, like it's going to kill somebody or whatever, I can go over there immediately and deem it an unsafe structure. But basically what we were looking for, or what we got before, was something in the middle there. You know, rather than me either not going out at all or going out and condemning a building and actually telling people they basically need to leave the structure immediately,
mm-hmm,
we needed something in the middle there. And that's where we got it to the property maintenance. Do you want to adopt the property maintenance code? That was, you know, big, and then the rental inspection district, and then we narrowed it all the way down to basically a onesie, you know, one at a time type of thing, where if the board thinks there's something that needs to be dealt with as far as, you know, trying to get them to abate the problem, fix the property, or do anything less than going over there and just saying this is an unsafe structure and it needs to be, you know, taken care of immediately, that's where this procedure would come in. So that gives you guys a way of, if some, you know, constituents come and say, we really don't like this building on the corner, and I can't go down and can, you know, say it's unsafe, it needs to be, but it's a little less than that, but it is unsightly, or there are, you know, there's a rat infestation or something like that. This gives you a way of saying, okay, we'll have Kevin go out there, the building officials go out there and start this process, give them a little bit more time to abate the problem rather than immediately condemn the building.
So we have the opportunity that a constituent would come to us, or what if they call a building department and say, I don't like this building?
Yeah.
Then you would bring it to us?
Well, that I would maybe bring it to Eric and then say, Eric, you got to discuss it with the board. Okay. And then tell me to start the process.
The statute actually authorizes the county administrator to initiate the problem. So if somebody came to Mrs. Eager and said, you know, we've got this spot blighted property, she could bring that to Mr. Dahl, and then depending on the circumstances, he could either initiate Mr. Zoll's actions or he could take it to you and have you do it, make the decision.
So what would go on at a public hearing? The person with the property would come sit in here and we ask some questions.
That's the way the law is written.
And that's the final decision. We have the final decision. What can the person do? Can they appeal?
No formal method of appeal. I suppose they could challenge it in court. But you know, I've dealt with these properties before, and I've never yet seen a governing body that was interested in just taking up this action just to harass the owner. You don't act unless and until you've got a pretty obvious problem.
Like I said, there's a 30-day period for a response, then there's a 90-day period for them to abate the problem, and if they don't do it at that point, and obviously, if they're making some type of efforts, maybe we can give them, you know, a slight extension, but we're not gonna just continually give people extensions if there's an issue. But if they're working to fix the problem, and maybe it's a larger problem than 90 days can cure, maybe then that's something that we would have to, you know, look at a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure, Mr. Payne, what do you?
No, that's right. The 30 and 60 come from the statute. If you act under the existing ordinance, those time limits don't apply. There's a different procedure. But understand that this does not necessarily mean Mr. Zoll goes out and sees the subject property and it's got problems. He's not automatically going to go and fire up the bulldozer and tear it down. It might easily be the case that the problem is that the structure is unsafe under certain conditions. But if, for example, you boarded it up so you couldn't get into it, that might solve the problem. Or if you had an infestation of rats, if you exterminated the rats, that might solve the problem. So don't get the idea that this means Mr. Zoll's going to go out riding on his black horse through the county with torches burning his houses down. That's not what this is about.
Well, very often when a property gets into this condition, it's because the person has moved away or they don't have the money to fix it. So if they put that property for sale, then what would the county do?
If
they've got a blight and the owner put it on the market to sell because he could not afford to fix it, what would the county's answer to that be?
Well, I would think
it depends on the circumstances, because if you have something that's a real emergency, I think the county would take action, whatever the action was necessary.
If it's a health hazard to the community, I mean, it can be boarded up, or the building official could take action immediately.
Yeah, you could do that. So that's why there's no hard time limit on the actions under the ordinance. The other thing is, that could be part of the abatement process. So Mr. Zoll goes out and tells this guy he's got, you know, this house has these problems, whatever they are, and they're remediable, but you know, it's not something where you slap a little paint on, it's fine. It might involve a lot of money and considerable time. He might come in and say, I don't have the money to fix it, but I have somebody that wants to buy it and fix it up. And that he submits that as his plan. Then there's no reason you couldn't do that in an appropriate case. But it would be, that would be a matter of your and his discretion.
But just that happens at times when maybe family's gone, there's nobody in the county that's responsible for the property, and it gets blighted or not tidy or taken care of. And sometimes people out of state just don't know how to handle that other than to put it up for sale.
That might be a perfectly adequate remedy in a given case.
But the newer's going to need to know that they're going to have to remedy the situation.
I remember one example, in fact, Mr. Sheridan would know this because it was the old Elks Lodge in the town of Columbia. That it was a fabulous building, stone. And I loved that building, but it got to the point where it wasn't habitable, it wasn't remediable. And it was sold, and the new owner took it down, transported it to his property, and rebuilt it. So that solved the problem without destroying the building. So that's one thing that could be done.
All right. Any other questions?
All right. Now, since this is already in our ordinance, there's really nothing.
There's no motion.
There's no motion for us to approve. We're just bringing forward the procedure to go through with the spotlight abatement. Obviously, this is not. There could be some slight tweaks to it, but it's generally pretty cut and dry as far as what the procedure is.
I wouldn't recommend any action on your
part. My only question was, dang, oh, this has been there. We did a lot of work to figure this out, and all of a sudden we go, okay, wait a second, it's here. All right. So, thank you, Mr. Zoll. All right, here we go. Consent agenda. F, minutes of November 6, 2019, Mr. Lease. G, FY20, public safety building equipment insurance claim, Ms. McGuire. H, FY20, Blue Valley County Public Schools insurance claim, 2015, Thomas Bus, VIN, number 5703, Ms. McGuire. And I, accounts payable report for October 2019, Ms. Twisdale. Do we have anything we'll pull? I've already pointed out to Mr. Weaver, I saw what you was looking at.
I had something too.
Okay. Was yours on the accounts payable, Ms. Eager?
No, it's minutes.
Oh, okay. Which one was that now?
It's on the page 446. And it says almost to the bottom of Mr. Weaver, the speed limit reduction was requested on Route 15 between Route 644 and Route 644. Is there is that right?
1644.
It's a loop.
Okay, so there's 644 goes into.
It starts and then it goes off and then it comes back.
Friendship Road.
So it loops off and it comes right back on.
Right. It just goes right back.
It doesn't sometimes look right when we have it's red. I had to check it myself.
When you said 644, I was lost. Well, Salem Church doesn't make it all the way back. It comes out on 616.
Okay.
Yeah.
Salem Church was part of the original road that passed Palmyra. It was replaced in 15. That's right. Why you get these loops.
But yes, ma'am, that explains that one. All right, Mr. Weaver.
Okay. 477 Central Virginia Electric Co-op, Columbia School. What are we doing over at Columbia School now?
That's a tower.
Okay, we're going back to that again.
That's the only thing we've still got.
Yeah, we're not paying for the electricity for the school.
Sold
that as long.
Yeah, I know. That's the reason that I was looking at it.
We'll have to see what we can do to get Steve back to maybe change the description on that bill.
Anything else, Mr. Weaver?
What about 527? Maintenance contract on the waste container lift charges. What was that? Is it $1,946?
That's our what we get charged for them to pick up our dumpsters.
Yeah,
just here,
Calvin, for Republic Services. We a bill for $1,900. Does that sound pro? What's that sound like?
Republic Services.
The pickup of all of the containers because we have a container here at this building. Harrisburg Sheriff's Office. We have a couple of them around the county, just single containers for the trash in those buildings. And that's what that would be for.
And where's that trash go?
I'm sorry?
Where does that trash go?
Wherever
they take it.
It doesn't.
Why aren't we doing that?
We don't have the equipment to do that.
Yeah, these are the big dumpsters, you know, the giant brown dumpsters.
It just seems like there's something not clicking with us, with the landfill there. I keep seeing those figures, $1,900.
Weaver, if you want us to buy trucks to start picking up containers, we can certainly.
Well, if you want us to buy, we can do that.
Hey, well, how many months is that for? Is that per month, $1,900, or is that?
I believe that right now that's per month. Yeah. We're actually working on a new contract, and those prices specifically for those trash dumpsters should go down. Because we're going to start picking them up not as often. So that price will go down in the future months. But we are in the process of working on the whole new contract for all of the
trash services.
So the $24,000 maybe that we're paying right now a year, that might very well be cut.
The cost for the trash at the actual convenience center probably won't change much.
I understand that. That's completely independent, as I understand.
Right. But
that's the reason I'm questioning this.
The ones for the dumpsters at our buildings, that should go down.
And you'll give us those figures later and let us know how that works out?
Yeah, I'm hoping at the next meeting in December, or the last meeting in December, I'll be able to have that contract to you guys.
Right, and then also several months ago, we had talked about contracts with the termite company and all of that, and you were talking about maybe getting new bids on that. Have we gone any further on that?
I haven't gone any further on that yet. We've been concentrating on the convenience center because that's the big one, and then the pest services will be the next one I look at.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's it for PIP.
Yes, sir. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move to approve agendas F through I and the accounts payable and payroll for October 2019 in the amount of $3,359,262.49.
Second. Motion made by Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Is there any unfinished business?
So, Mr. Chair, I've got three items I would like to discuss if we can, and I'll give you the topics of them, and you decide which one, or the board can say no, I don't want to discuss them, or which ones you want to go first. So, one, we've got a slight update to the SCBA grant that we applied for that we didn't get. One, there's some new information about the board's decision last meeting about the fire truck. I got some information about the fire truck and some additional information on that. And then thirdly, and these are things that we've all discussed before, there's been some discussion about not getting information on Lake Monticello Owners Association votes list for personal property taxes. So those are three items that.
Say that again.
So the Lake Monticello personal property boats list.
Mm-hmm. And you said they were talking about not getting the information?
Correct.
All right. Well, I'd like to hear the news from the SCBAs real quick, if that's okay, folks. I don't think this is going to take long.
No,
hopefully this will be some type of good news.
It could. It could.
We're going to hope. We're going to keep our fingers crossed.
I hopefully it's good news. So when they gave us our rejection letter, there was nothing on it except that this year they did a new procedure, what they called a turndown webinar, which I watched the turndown webinar, and the guys basically gave us the top reasons why you're not approved on the grant. And then they said, if you can't figure it out looking at your grant, give us 2 weeks, call us. So I did. Had a long talk with the gentleman, and he pulled our grant, and he said, this is a really good grant. And I said, well, it doesn't matter. You know, we tried twice. We can't try again. And he's like, no. The grant cycle opens again December 2nd. So what he told me we can do, and he told me the two things to fix on the grant, and he said, you have a better than average chance submitting it. He said, we submitted December 2nd. Then we purchased the SCBAs and called him and tell him we have to do an emergency purchase because of like the last structure fire where people had to bail because of things not working. And then we are still in the running and we can still get the grant. So yeah, we could apply again.
And what was that amount again that we're applying for?
$818.
That's a total cost for all of this.
Well, yeah, the board, I mean, the county was putting in $200,000, and then $616,000 that we were looking for from the grant. So,
well, that's great.
So, but now it's not guaranteed.
Well,
nothing's guaranteed.
We get $200,000.
I'll take another shot at it.
Right, exactly.
For $600,000, I'll take another shot at it too.
Right. So and his words were, him looking at it, he said, "I think you've got a better than average chance." Apply. I mean, he was like, "No, apply again, apply again."
Who was this that told you that?
It's his name was Kevin Payat from FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
Up in Fairfax.
And how did that come about, that conversation?
Well, because I watched the turndown webinar, as they called it, and then I waited the week and a half, 2 weeks that they asked, and then I called him and said, and I had explained to him, I said, "Look, we don't have anything to apply for, but me, I want to know, you know, what anything we can fix, what we can do wrong, you know, what
for the next time we do something like this."
Yeah. I said, "We're not going to apply again, but me, I just like to know if there's anything we could fix."
So if you hadn't looked at the webinar, you wouldn't have known that there was another December the 2nd application.
Well,
did you know that?
We knew it. We knew there was, but we
right.
thought that because we were now going to have to purchase
right.
it, mm-hmm. that would be supplanting.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't do that. He said, "No, you wait till you submit, and then you purchase, and call him and tell him we had to do an emergency purchase, and we're still allowed to apply."
Now, just remember, if we apply to the grant, obviously we can't wait long to move forward, so we're going to have to put the money up front, but maybe in April, May, June timeframe.
Right, hopefully.
It might be even later than that.
I can call him back and ask him when they think they might award, but
whenever they award, we're going to get them in December. We're going to get them in December. We're going to order them in December.
Right.
Yes. And if we get money back,
sounds great.
That's money to put back in.
Right. Right. Exactly. Then we get it back, and if we don't, we haven't lost it.
If we did, then we're right back to where we are right now.
And he even told you what to fix on the grant.
That's good.
Yep.
All right.
So, then I guess, do we have to just put something?
Just stay right there. Just stay right there. But while you're up here, might as well talk about what's the information.
So I got some information that fire truck that was presented last week may or may not, for the 655, the full amount that may not equip the truck completely, like everything on the truck that's needed. So I sent an email to the chief saying, "Hey, look, I need to know." I said, "Is this 655? Is this going to fund everything for that truck? Does it put the hoses on the truck, the equipment, this, that, and the other?" And at first, I got an answer that was no. But then I got a kind of a follow up email that said, "So if they when they sell their current truck, I guess what's that, engine 20?" Engine 20, once they sell that, then they will have the money to buy the equipment for the new truck. And then, from what it sounds like, then the money that they get within the next year will be able to fund additional things on the truck. Now, my only issue with this is, okay, if you're coming to the county and you want to buy a truck, I don't care what it is, give us the full amount of what it is. Don't nickel and dime it. Or if you're using operations dollars to fund kind of some of the equipment on the truck, I don't think that's my intent. That's not what the board's intent is when we fund operations. Operations is to buy supplies, to fix vehicles, to maybe maintain vehicles as they go. But I don't see the operations dollars necessarily being there to finish outfitting the truck when the county maybe didn't give as much money as that should be there. So from my standpoint, if you're gonna buy a truck and it's $675,000. Well, tell us up front it's $675,000. Don't say we need $655,000, and then, oh, by the way, we're going to sell this truck, and then that $20,000 we'll put in here, and it's going to take however long to purchase the, you know, sell the truck and then buy the new equipment, and then, oh, by the way, then we're going to, you know, use some of our other dollars, and then we're going to buy additional equipment. To me, it's just, from the county standpoint, I think we need to know what that cost is up front.
Well, and the truck might not be usable if it wasn't outfitted.
It's not usable if it's not outfitted. I mean, we're talking about the hoses, we're talking about the nozzles, we're talking about the
saws,
all the hydraulic equipment. I mean,
yeah, I think we should know
exactly what it's going to cost. Have we been doing that in the past, paying for
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't know. I mean, we shouldn't be. I mean, when companies come to us and say, look, we want to buy a truck, give me the price that it's going to be. Now, maybe there's been times in the past where the county didn't fund the full amount, and maybe they had to, you know, pull a little bit from here and there, but... You know, from the county standpoint, that's why we want to be involved with the purchase, because we need to know what that truck costs. If you're saying it costs this, but then, and when I say behind the scenes, I don't mean behind the scenes, but then on your operations and other things, you're buying all this stuff to completely outfit a truck that's road ready. To me, that's just not the way to go about it. We should know what the full cost of that truck is over.
Yeah, I mean, personally, we talked about this when we're funding some of the trucks and engines, I find it really difficult to be put in a position as a board supervisor to make decisions on individual vehicles, of which I know very little about, and I have to listen to varying opinions from people that I consider experts on the subject matter. And then to be put in a position where either the information is incomplete or there's lack of consensus as to what the value is or isn't, I think that that's just a really bad process. And I certainly think that the FRA should, you know, say, here are fleet maintenance needs and requirements, and here's what we need to fund and the order that we need to fund it in, and that they have that consensus and that they bring that forward, and whether we're financing that with a debt or whether we're financing that by putting it into an MRR, that's a much better and cleaner way than the way we've been doing it, which is sort of these one-off acquisitions. And that's, you know, with all respect to the fact that, you know, that each department, each chief goes out and looks for value where they can. I know that we got a great deal on Ladder 53, for example, or whatever. But, you know, yes, we want to look for those deals. And when they come up, that's fantastic. But by the same token, when we have needs like the last truck, and which when there's discussion about whether it was funded appropriately or outfitted appropriately, I should say, that's difficult. You know.
Well, I will say this much: there were questions asked last week that I couldn't answer, and I told y'all that when we were talking about airbags. Now I know the Chief 30 is here, Mr. Fullen's here. And I'm going to ask him just to come up and speak to our truck.
I think that's inappropriate because you don't have the other people here and the decision's made.
Well, we didn't have him here last week.
No, I know. But my point is that this is something that the FRA should be doing on its own. We shouldn't be hearing from separate parties as to whether or not this is the right thing, in my opinion.
I'm not going to ask whether or not it's the right thing. I'm going to ask about the safety of the vehicle that we've
bought. Well, first of all, it's not in the agenda. So I think it's out of order from that standpoint.
Mr. Payne, you have to take a vote for that. Well, Mr. Payne,
sure.
Do we have an issue with that?
I don't understand your question.
We're talking about stuff that happened at the last meeting. Offered the opportunity for...
It's not on the agenda. It was brought to you by the county administrator as old business.
Right. But my point is that you don't have the counterparties that are to make their discussion.
I can't. The board can discuss anything it wants if the board chooses to do so.
Yeah. Would y'all like to hear?
Yes.
Yeah, I would.
I don't know.
But ma'am, it's 3-2 right now.
Right, but what I'm saying is that it's already preconceived because he's here. The person you're going to call is here.
Okay.
Well, how could he just come here unless you knew he was coming here?
I didn't know he was coming here, ma'am. He walked in late.
I don't know something that I thought about this afternoon. And I'd like to read it to you. All of our tankers are commercial, and we were led to believe that a custom cab was necessary for the safety of our firemen. But does that mean that all the other firemen are not as safe because they have the other kind of cab, the custom cab? And I think we should rethink this decision because all the trucks should be commercial. Most fire trucks throughout the state of Virginia are commercial.
I don't have any objection to revisiting this. Okay. I have an objection to revisiting it without the counterparty being here. That's my objection.
Okay, can I finish?
No, I know, but I'm saying we shouldn't even be discussing it.
We approved.
That's your opinion. Y'all spoke in your opinion.
We approved the 18, $118,000 cost at our last meeting for the SCBAs, and this truly is a necessity, one that we are fully responsible for unless we can get another grant, which we didn't know till tonight. And this expense is a top priority. A new water rescue truck with less than 100,000 miles and a custom cab on a fire truck isn't essential. And this is particularly difficult. It's a particularly difficult year, and the water rescue truck and the 14-unit fire truck should be revisited and perhaps put off until we're not as tight financially, because our undesignated fund balance is now $1,761,969. So I'm just worried about everybody else's needs. If we can put something off.
Because I'm one of the lives that would be on the line, man.
That's right.
And I don't want to put my life on the line.
Well, what I do procedurally, I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, procedurally, for the board to revisit a vote that's been taken, how does that stand by Robert's Rules of Order? So, in other words, we're being asked, and I know that we're not necessarily being asked to do that right now, to revisit a motion that was passed last time, and I'm just asking procedurally
Is this a decision on purchase thing?
Yes.
And it has not been executed, I think you can withdraw it.
Okay, what's the procedure to do that, though?
Is it
under old business, new business?
It's under old business.
Well,
technically it would be new business, right?
Yeah, I think it would probably. Okay.
So it should be on the agenda listed as new business.
It should best be on the agenda.
Okay. It can be brought up as new business. We've done many things this way.
No, but it should be on the agenda as well, too.
Okay, I mean, nobody's talking about taking a vote tonight. Are we breaking a rule if we ask them to speak, Mr. Banning?
I'm sorry.
If we have three people that want to hear a gentleman speak, are we breaking the rule?
No, you can, because you can hear the subject. It doesn't mean you necessarily decide it, but you can hear it if you want to.
Okay.
If a majority of the board wants to do it, you can do it.
Okay. All right. Mr. Bullen, will you please come up real quick? I'd just like to ask you about the safety of the truck that we've ordered. And let's make sure we're not overstepping bounds. I'm asking you about the safety of the truck.
My chief should be here.
Ms. Booker. Ms. Booker.
My chief should be here.
Yes, ma'am.
I want that to go on record.
To Ms. Booker's point, I agree. Mm-hmm. Your chief should be here.
Yes.
But all the chiefs should be here.
Yes.
When they discussed it last time, mm-hmm. and when they discussed Kent Storrs' issue specifically, I should have been here.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I think the FRA is unorganized, and we know nothing about any of these things that come to you. So I actually agree with Mr. O'Brien, and I agree with Ms. Booker. And to your point about the Fire Rescue Association,
which that wasn't brought up 2 weeks ago. When they brought up, when the questions were asked about our container.
Yeah, I had no idea this was even coming to you. So I agree with you. I absolutely do.
And I, by the way, I appreciate your comments. I just felt that it was unfortunate that you weren't here to make those comments when we were making that decision.
I had no idea. So you're right.
But I mean, that was listed on the agenda. So, I mean, that's, in other words, I'm not a criticism of you. I'm just saying that that's part of that process where, mm-hmm. you know, I guess you can probably tell I'm a little angry about this because I really care about what you guys do.
Yes.
And I just feel like we're put in a bad position. I know that everybody's well-intentioned. And I'm not dismissing your comments or anything along those lines.
It's all about the order. I think that the best way to move forward is for a board member to probably come to the Fire Rescue Association meetings more often, whether y'all rotate through, because this happens over and over and over again. And when last month we're in closed session discussing something, this month we're having meetings, you know, 2 weeks ago that I didn't even know were on the agenda. So I agree with you. Mm-hmm. To Mr. Sheridan's point, every school bus in the county, none of them has airbags.
Right.
Okay. You can buy a custom cab from Pierce, which is one of many manufacturers, which has the side curtain airbags, and all, it just depends on what manufacturer you pick.
All of them have something that you can buy that would increase the safety. For us specifically, the reason that I was upset, the comment was made that we may have sacrificed safety for cost. Well, we decided on a commercial cab, and I'm not saying they should get a commercial cab or custom cab. That's not my decision. I'm not their chief. For us, and the people that drive these trucks in Kent Store, on Kent Store roads, commercial cabs seem to be safer because the wheels are out front. There's more vision. You have the entire engine compartment in front of you, so if you hit something head on, there's obviously more protection. And they, most of them do have airbags, the traditional airbags that you have in the steering wheel and the glove box. Now, Freightliner next year is coming out with the same airbags that you all discussed in the last meeting. They're going to have those same airbags on their commercial chassis as well. But it's just, it's all in what you want. What we did differently was we decided this is what we want the apparatus to do. And of course, we did the money that you all provide us would never be enough to do what we wanted with $585,000. So we had to make a decision. We can't get a custom cab, or we can get one and go outside of Pierce, which is Pierce's traditionally the manufacturer that we choose in Fluvanna. So without having a competitive bidding process on the county's end, we did that on our own. We put out the spec, and Rosenbauer, KME, Pierce, and Spartan, and a company called Four Guys all came to us with their plan. And Pierce at the beginning was the most expensive. And then after we were presented with all the costs, they actually cut, I want to say it was $40,000 from their cost so that they could be more competitive. And we ended up going with Pierce. Not because that's who everybody around us has, but because they were the most competitive and was the most bang for the buck. And then while we were on our pre-engineering trip, we ended up cutting more off that cost. And right now we're probably, it can vary a little because things change, but we're between $485,000 and $500,000 now.
But so that's not...
That's a commercial...
That's not outfitted.
No, so that's the other thing. When I build a truck, it's the complete truck. You can have the apparatus delivered at $600,000, $650,000, but it's not doing anybody any good sitting there. And we receive $40,000 a year from the county, plus $20,000 a year aid to locality money from the state. And then if we fundraise and, you know, other revenues like that, it costs $75,000 at least to outfit a new fire truck, at least. And that's on the low end. So you have to plan long-term to outfit this truck. And selling an engine that you may get $20,000 for, if you're lucky, on gov deals, is not going to outfit it. You have to have a long-term plan to do that. So what we did was incorporate the cost of what really are capital items, hose, appliances, hand tools, hydraulic tools. Those are going to be things that we use for 20 years at least. So we incorporate that into the cost, and we're still under budget.
I just think for the county going forward, and you know, this whole thing about making companies have to pay interest and stuff like that, I don't think the county should do that. I think we should know what the full cost is of the truck up front, and then the board has the best decision to say, look, this truck's going to cost $650,000. Another $75,000 in equipment.
I'm very appreciative of Mr. Pullen's efforts to try to find ways to save the county money. I really am. I think that's terrific.
What we did was we sent an equipment list to the former county administrator.
Yeah.
This is the equipment list. This is the price of the engine. This is what we, like I said, these numbers are going to change. You're going to go down there for pre-engineering, mm-hmm. and they're going to say, man, I wish we'd add a light here. I wish we would have done this. The new standard says we must have these reflective stripes. Some things are going to vary.
But here's my point, I think, is that it isn't like, and you say it yourself, I mean, really the FRA should be doing this. It mm-hmm. seems to me that if the decision should be changed, the FRA should come back and say, we got together as a group, we reviewed the specs, and we decided as captains or chiefs that this would be the right decision and the better use of our funds.
There is an app. There's a comprehensive plan, obviously, for apparatus replacement. We could debate the comprehensive plan, but that's not important right now. The engine was moved up a year. It was supposed to be next year. It was moved up a year to this year.
We did that last year in budget season. Yeah, yes. We did
that. You moved the engine up.
Budget.
they have a chief who has an apparatus committee, which is traditionally what we all, just like I do. And they just, every district is different. Lake Monticello needs something different than what Fort Kenny needs and different than what Kent Store needs. We all have different responsibilities and they have the Fort Kenny Military Academy and they have some storefronts and then they have roads like we do. So they have to be able to accommodate all of that. So they might not need the same kind of truck that we need. So to have a one-size-fits-all apparatus.
That's not what I don't think that's what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is that the FRA, you know, because we literally had three chiefs up here shaking their heads saying, yes, we need this cat. Okay, that's, you know, and that's what we had. And so four of us voted for that. Now we're being told that that decision was wasteful.
I'm
not saying you're saying that. I'm saying that the perception might be that this was a wasteful decision, that it was too cushy, that it was not a need to have.
I'm not going to tell any other chief what they need.
I personally, as a board member, I don't want to be voting on one-off trucks. I don't want to be voting on the interest of one particular chief against the general consensus of the chiefs as to what would be the best way to do this. Because I think you guys are the best outfitted to make those kinds of recommendations to us.
I hate to tell you this, but y'all are going to have to hire a fire chief to accommodate that.
Well, maybe we will, okay? I mean, maybe
because
we
you're
will.
Going to have everybody...
that may be a conversation down the road.
Need an advocate for you.
I agree.
And this is one thing you and I had the conversation about. Y'all, because I am a fireman, because I've been involved with it for 30 years, everybody goes, well, you're an expert. I'm no expert. I don't know the trucks inside and out. I mean, these guys will tell you. I got to sit there and scratch my head to make a thing pump water sometimes.
And the truth is, just because you're a fireman does not mean that you're an expert on building apparatus. I'm not. There's some people here that are... We have people that run with us, that volunteer with us. I'll use one that owns his own landscaping company. He knows those diesel engines inside and out better than I do. So we need him to look at the diesel engines. We need someone else to look at how the chassis is built.
Sure.
It's kind of like we look at the board. You know, you've said this before. We're all from such varying and different backgrounds that we complement each other.
Sure.
And it's the same thing with that organization.
A lot of these are sales tactics. These salesmen are selling million-dollar fire trucks, and a lot of these are sales tactics. And
but to go back to the custom truck versus commercial cattle, to me, that's not really the question, because I think I had Debbie pull some information on other chiefs, and some chiefs, custom cabs are the way to go. They say they're the way to go. That's what they prefer.
Yeah.
You know, for a varied reasons. Just from our standpoint, I don't really care what type of vehicles, what type of apparatus you buy. The chiefs know what's best. I think from the county standpoint, we just need to know what does that cost up front, and we should be ponying up the money for that cost if we think that truck is valuable and important, and we shouldn't be nickel and diamond, like, you know, trying to collect, you know, $3,000 a year from all the companies.
I don't disagree with anything.
We just need to know the real cost, and that may help
a lot of the situation if we do that.
Does anybody else have a question?
Maybe nationwide there's more commercial cabs, that's probably true, but across the Commonwealth, everywhere south of Fluvanna, you'll see commercial cabs. Southwest Virginia, you'll see commercial cabs. Most of
the back road places.
Yeah, the suburban and urban area, like where I work at, we only have one commercial cab there, just because the turning radius and everything. All these trucks are built for the area they have to respond in. And I promise you, these manufacturers are not producing, whether it's a commercial cab or custom cab, they're not producing thousands of trucks that are unsafe.
Let me ask you, because I brought this up last time, you know, when we were at budget season, about the whole, give us a plan, figure this out. Let's put the debt behind that so that we know what we're going to do, so that we're not figuring this out every year. Is it an unreasonable thing for the FRA to be able to sit down and say, here's, you know, because we're entering into a period of time where, you know, has been pointed out, the fund balance is low. You know, there's just not a lot of extra cushion, right? So, for lack of better words, it's going to be tight, right? And I think the board has done a lot to try to strengthen the fire and rescue services and to provide for their needs to the best of our ability from that standpoint. And I think fire, you know, in general that everybody's aware, and the chiefs are all aware that the budget's tight, but it's their job to advocate for what they want and what they need. That's their job. That's important for them to do. Within that, there's going to be a variety of people. Some who say, I can do it, you know, on a shoestring, and some who say, you know, I need to have the Cadillac.
I'm usually the shoestring.
Okay, I'm not, you know, not pointing out names, but you're going to have a little bit of both from that standpoint. But it seems to me that if the FRA was to say, here are the next four trucks that we're going to need in the next 5 years, or whatever the case may be, we think it's going to cost this much overall, and we've talked as a group, and we've discuss the back and forth, because we know that we will want to use funds for some of the other things, SCBAs or whatever the case may be, fire building, whatever. That if two of the chiefs said, yep, that's absolutely the right way to go, and two of them said, that's not the way to go, okay, well, you guys hash it out, and then maybe we have to make that decision. But if three of the chiefs came back and said, this is the right truck, and the other chief says, hey, well, I really want this one, seems to me that's an easier decision for the board to make right there, right?
Yeah, I would also say that you didn't have three, you had a water rescue chief, and you had, I would be careful, just because they have titles does not mean they're experts.
Again, but you know what? They are the people that are putting their lives at the front line and that are managing those companies, and so therefore I am certainly not in the position to make the decision as to whether they're expert on that particular subject matter or not, right?
There wasn't three fire chiefs sitting here.
Okay, that may
be. Two of the county fire chiefs were not here. We're not present. Company one and company three.
And him and I are on the same page.
This should be something that
the fire and rescue discusses. Right. But right. I just wanted to hear. I couldn't answer questions that were asked last week. Okay. Now, I couldn't answer those.
Now, if you all want to go with us to Bradenton, Florida, and look at these trucks, come with us. Go to Florida with us.
I will be driving down there on December 13th.
We've been for pre-engineering. We'll go for post-paint. It's a quick trip, but it's 10, 11 hours of work each day. But we go down there and visit the plant.
They fly down. I don't fly.
I don't like to fly either, but I did.
I'm driving.
You can drive. But come down there and look, and you can sit in the cabs. They build custom and commercial cabs at that plant. We chose a commercial, and that's primarily what they produce there.
Okay.
But get in the truck, and you can see the ins and outs and all the intricacies. And that's what I would suggest. And I understand your point, and I agree with you. I don't, without hiring an advocate for you all, I don't know how you're going to get around that.
Really all right. Don't. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Poole.
You're welcome.
All righty.
And so the last one, I was asking Mr. Payne if that was regarding the Lake Monticello list. Mr. Payne, you want to?
This is something that you all discussed a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And it was that there appeared to be a number of boats which are subject to personal property taxation, number of boats that are not being taxed. They should be. Now, there's a statute that requires marina owners, on request of the Commissioner of Revenue, to report what boats are there under, I think there are three different categories, and report them according to category. And the information that we've received is that in the case of Lake Monticello, the reports are not complete. There are boats there that are not being reported. The way these things go, this is like your car taxation, except the car goes to DMV and the boat goes to DGIF. But it works essentially the same way that DGIF reports it back to the county for imposition of personal property tax. And that's the issue, as I understand it. They're not filing complete reports. No, the marina is not.
Well, what do you do about the situation?
Well, I mean, the only thing we could do, I mean, I've reached out to the general, I've reached out to the general manager, let him know that we're interested in finding out more about this because we have not been getting complete information and that we're going to discuss it. I mean, with the exception of having the board and having the general manager here, or I'm not sure what the county can do from our standpoint.
Again, I'm going to object to discussing this right now, again, without parties being here. I just think it's bad form. It's not representative, and it doesn't give the other party an opportunity to tell us what they have or haven't been doing. So I'm just saying, I think this is bad form.
I agree with you on this particular issue also, because it's more direct, because it concerns you, and you're obviously outnumbered, and I think that
No. I mean, I'm as Mr. Payne pointed out, there's a statute. If conversations have been had, then the next step is how's that enforcement happen? If it has to come to the board, that's maybe a different step.
In the first instance, this is between the marina and the commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem to me that it makes sense. I don't disagree with you necessarily, Mr. O'Brien, about putting it on the agenda.
No, I think it seems entirely needs to be on the agenda.
It seems to me that the way to do that would be to ask the commissioner to report to you on this issue.
And ask the general manager to come if he wants to. Yep. That's absolutely fine.
Okay, so you'd rather Mr. Sheridan not speak then?
Mr. O'Brien has a good
point. That's fine.
I didn't ask to speak.
No, I know you didn't, and I'm not,
I was asked to be here.
I think that...
I'm sure why. I was told it would be in closed session.
The best way to solve the...
Clearly.
You were asked to be here.
The best way to address the procedural issue, as far as I'm concerned, is to set this on the agenda for a more full consideration. Ask Mr. Sheridan to be there to report on the status of things. And make the general manager aware that it's going to be discussed.
Thank you. Sorry. Mr. Sheridan.
That is my prerogative because it's personal property. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you for your support. I'll leave it at that. I'm moving back for a while about this. Thank you. I'm not sure why.
So you want it just as a presentation or
put it on the agenda and let the general manager know that it's coming to the board?
I won't speak right now unless you tell me I can't, and then I won't come back.
I think it would be most appropriate to set it as a presentation.
The rules are real simple. This happens to be personal property with respect to any planned community that has a marina. There's a requirement that boats that are maintained at the marina are supposed to be reported by the marina to the Commissioner of Revenue. That's a statute that requires that. I'll leave it at that. You all know as well as I do, probably 90% of the boats up there aren't stored at the marina. They're stored at individual docks and garages. For what it's worth, this has nothing to do with this particular planned community. Let's take Lake of the Woods in Orange County. Boats in general are maintained, if they are registered, they're registered with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. They're not registered with, DMV. And boats don't have to be registered with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, DGIF, unless they're going to be used on public water. You want to put any boat in the Ravenna or the James, you by law should have a registration by DGIF, provided it's a motorized boat that exceeds canoe length. But if it's on private water, like a private pond, I have a pond. If I had a 24-foot pontoon boat on it, I'm not required to put a
sticker. When you drive down Route 250 to Richmond, there's a boat,
but
there's a pond that has a 24-foot pond.
In any planned community like Lake of the Woods, Lake Louise, of Lake Monticello, that's private water. There's no requirement to have your boat registered with DGIF. I think most of those communities require boat owners that want to use them on their water to register them with their association, whether that's a marina or however they do it. And that's really the rub. There's no requirement for them to report those to any commissioner, but there are a lot of them there in any private water. I'll leave it at that. Y'all know the rest of the issue. So, and they don't report them after repeated requests to do so.
All right. Was there anything else, Mr. Dahl? All righty. Is there any new business? Hearing none, I will now open the second round of public comment. Anyone wish to speak at this time, please approach the witness chair. Keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and direct it to the board. Does anyone wish to speak at this time?
Yes, sir. I'd like to speak. Mel Sheridan, the president of Kensdorf Fire Department. I live at 89 Covered Bridge Road, Kensdorf, Virginia. I just want to speak to the Kensdorf potential purchase of a fire truck. What y'all do with any of my brother or sister fire stations is certainly the board's prerogative. But I think it's important to take a look at the process that Air Company has had to go through in trying to be fiscally responsible and professional. It was determined we needed to replace a particular piece of apparatus, an engine. And the board determined how much money we would receive to try to make that replacement, $585,000. And that may not buy a custom cab, which we, with the funds necessary, I think, frankly, we wanted to look at the whole cost, the cost to replace the vehicle, purchase the vehicle, and equip it. Any vehicle that's not equipped is just useless to you. Might as well not have wheels on it. And that cost is anywhere in between $70,000 to $90,000. And you go over lots of it, but probably $15,000 worth of four-inch hose on it right off the bat. So you need a comprehensive plan to buy the vehicle and replace the equipment. That's what Kensdorf, and in trying to be fiscally responsible with your money, our county's money, we conducted a very competitive bid process. We didn't just say that we want this particular truck, you know, branded truck. We went, found four companies, and they went through the ringer, making presentations, drawing up designs, presenting to their truck committee, and negotiated one, frankly, against the other. And therein generated some very significant cost savings. We were able to negotiate that down to a $500,000 purchase of the truck, give or take a few thousand, as Chief Pullen said. And I want to be very clear. We do not feel for our company that we sacrifice safety in the least. For us, it was the right way to find a fiscally responsible opportunity to purchase and equip a truck with the money that y'all had given us, which was $585,000. And we will do that. I mean, we'll buy a brand new truck, replace a 20-some-year-old truck. Is that better? I think it's tremendously better. We don't have 20-year-old brakes, 20-year-old brake lines. We have the technology of 2020 versus the technology of 1999 or whatever. Now, could we have spent more money? Sure we could have. I would love to have spent more money, but that wasn't fiscally responsible for us because, frankly, we didn't have the money from y'all to do it. And to buy that vehicle and put it in their station without it being operational, i.e. being equipped, would not be doing a very, it would be a disservice to our county and their company and to this board, who gave us that much money, $585,000, a lot of money. We could have spent a considerable amount more than what we did. I would love to up-armor that vehicle. You give me $2 million, and I'll give you a fire truck that's bulletproof, one that you can turn over and it won't crush. There are always things that can be added to it, but I just wanted to be very clear. I've been on that committee. I've been down to Sarasota, where it really is a beautiful area, by the way. And we believe we have specced out, will buy and equip a brand new fire truck that will meet our needs for at least 20 more years with the money you gave us. And I think that's being responsible with the funds that you lend to us. And we, again, feel like we have not, absolutely not sacrificed the safety of the people that will drive that in Company 3 at all. Or we wouldn't put them in. And I thought it would be appropriate to at least tell you all that. It's an excellent deal for the money you had for us to spend. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else wishing to speak at this time? Seeing no one, I will now close second round of public comment. Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, I move the Vanna County Board of Supervisors enter into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.2.3711A6 of the Code of Virginia 1950, as amended for the purposes of discussing investment of funds.
All righty. Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Weaver. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Wake up, Tony.
I got it. Again, chair votes aye. Mr. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, I move to close meeting be adjourned and the Flavanna County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be resolved, Board of Supervisors is hereby certified to the best of each member's knowledge, one, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2.3711A1 of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Second.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. Ms. Weaver? Mr. Weaver? Ms. Booker? Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So made.
Do I have a second?
Second.
A motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
See you next week. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Chair votes aye. We are now.